Today's Taisho will be on case 80 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 80 is entitled, Joshu's a Newborn Baby. Main subject, a monk asked Joshu, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Joshu said, it is like throwing a ball into the rapids. The monk later asked Tosu, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said, nen after nen, without ceasing. Secho's verse, the six senses, the question, the six senses, purposeless. Well acquainted with it, the masters, a ball is thrown into the rapids. Do you know where it is carried? Today is day two of our August, of our autumn session. Feels like August. We had a very deep sitting, even though the alarm system went off. I noticed that when it started to go off, people didn't even move. I thought that was really quite impressive. Very deep sitting this morning. I'm grateful to you for making such an excellent effort. And usually day one is a challenging day. By the end of day one, people are quite tired. And then day two is usually challenging also. But often on day two or day three, early on day three, things begin to change, as you know. I hope you are in the middle of that beautiful change. When we start doing Zen, we often come to the cushion with a lot of problems, a lot of things pursuing us to the cushion. I was thinking again this morning about this story. There was a graduate student in English who has been working on her dissertation for a long time, maybe 8 or 9 years. And many years ago, she sat with us. She started sitting with our group, and she actually came to at least one sesshin. I remember she was at a sesshin where we had an incredible rainstorm, a little bit like yesterday's rainstorm, and you could just hear the rain pouring. And there was also thunder and lightning. She came to that storm, came to that sesshin and heard that storm. But for some reason, she didn't come to another sesshin. And in fact, she eventually stopped practicing Zen. And that always amazes me. I have to say that since I started doing this, I have been entranced, enthralled, deeply engaged. I must say, I've just found this to be the most interesting thing in the world. And I understand people get, people have other interests. You know, it's not necessarily the case that everybody wants to do five sesshin a year and sit many times a week and so on and so on. But nevertheless, I'm always shocked when people don't appreciate or can't penetrate deeply enough to see what's going on, you know. So that woman came to really what was like, I thought, like a perfect sesshin. And we had this incredible show all around us, and we were all sitting in our deep samadhi minds listening to the sound of the thunder. And I can't think of anything quite as special as that, quite as remarkable as that. Having had a taste of Buddha reality, You know, she didn't come back, and that surprised me. But you know, when she recently finished her dissertation after many years, and is now very nervous, very fearful about the future. And she was speaking to somebody in our group who said, "Well, why don't you come to sit?" And after many, many years of not practicing, she came to sit, and she sat down on the cushion, and she just had like this wonderful sit. And I don't know what it would take to get her back to the cushion, but surely that's a good start, you know. There's something so liberating about this practice, I think, something so energizing and purifying. You know, we can get into our dilemmas, our heads, to an extraordinary degree. Right? I mean, just it's like a labyrinth, right? You know, should I do this? Should I do that? I should have done this. I should have done that. You know, it doesn't get any better as you get older. You know, people who are young think that, you know, old age will confer wisdom. But actually, there's no reason to assume that getting old will make you any wiser. That's just like a pure myth. Just sitting on your ass for 40 years doesn't make you wiser, you know? It just doesn't. And in fact, you know, many people I know who are my age are at least as confused as they probably were when they were, say, 12. In fact, you know, probably 12 is the time you were smartest, right? When you were 12, you knew it all, right? And then as you get older, it gets more and more baffling, right? And if you look at the world, it's a very baffling place. I mean, we don't seem to be able to solve some of our most fundamental problems as a society. And we have a global warming emergency, and nobody's responding to it. And so at the very top level, at like the macro level, there's this incredible confusion and lack of wisdom. And you know, when you look at the lower, the micro level, same thing. You know, I was talking to a person the other day who is 64, and she was. She has worked as a like clinical psychologist all her life, and she was telling me that she has panic attacks, and I thought that was interesting. She's a clinical psychologist, but she's struggled all her life with panic attacks. And I when she told me about her panic attacks, she's not in our group, by the way. This was not told to me in the context of Dokusan. This was in the context of a work, my job. And I met this person, and she's a clinical psychologist, and we were talking, and she did ask me some questions about meditation, and then she did tell me, you know, she was suffering from like panic attacks. And I said, "How long has that been going on?" And she said, "Since I was a little girl." And I thought, that's so sad, you know. So, you know, she's 64 now, and she still has panic attacks. So age doesn't necessarily confer wisdom on you, you know? And so it isn't the case that things get necessarily easier as you get older. I think that Zen is really like a path to a kind of wisdom. And that doesn't mean that people who do Zazen don't make mistakes. Please don't think that's the case. But what I mean is that I think that Zen has a kind, that Zen gives you a kind of simplicity, which is wisdom. You know, I've been doing Zen practice for 30-some years, and I never knew that the characters for Zen meant pointing to simplicity. But Jaru did that calligraphy that we have on the altar at the university. Somebody said, "What do those characters mean?" And I knew it meant Zen. But she said, "This character means pointing, and this character means simplicity." And I thought, "Wow! If only I'd known." You know, pointing to simplicity, of course. You know, I think Zen is all about pointing to simplicity, and I think this is really what makes us wise. This is why, when you're 12, you're smarter than when you're 58. You know? Because when you're 12, it's all so simple. Right? You're totally wrong about most things, but you don't know it. You know, and you think you're totally right. So you look around and you think, "Well, that's stupid." You know, the way I feel is the right way. You know, but when you get older, it gets more and more complicated. Right? Everything becomes like a labyrinth of perspectives. So it's like, you know, if I look at the problem this way, I'll do this. And if I look at the problem this way, I'll do that. And Bill says this, and he's a smart guy. But, you know, Jane says this, and she's a scientist. She must know. So the thing is that all of these people have different perspectives. And as we get older, we can get so confused trying to think of what is the truth of a certain situation, you know. And of course, the people have feelings, and they have emotional investment, and so on and so on. I have, at my workplace, I have two women who are really excellent. They both work for me. And they're both excellent. One is older than I am. And she is very hardworking person, right? Super hardworking. She's the kind of person who holds the our whole operation together. You know, she does the scheduling. She runs the remedial courses. She's like always on top of the details. And she's very, very good. She's been working with me for 20 years. Now, there's another person who is new and highly motivated and very energetic. And she's in her 30s. So she's probably 20 some years younger than Darcy. And very, very together, very competent, hardworking. And, you know, I see so much to admire in both of these people, and they can't stand each other. You know, when I hired the new person, my older employee, she was immediately sort of felt threatened, and they just don't get along at all. I was so surprised. And you know, it was like I finally, you know, asked them to go out to go have lunch. I said, "You two need to go to lunch." And I think they probably just eyed each other over their lunch. You know. So you know, this is so human. You know, and when they have disputes, you know, one person will come to see me and say, "Look, do you know what so and so she said? Blah 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 blah." You know, and then I'll think, "Oh, brother." And then the other person will, he'll come in and say, she said, "Look, that's not true. Here's what happened." And it's amazing. Like the differences in their accounts. The accounts are so different. I've even gone to third parties to see if, you know, anybody can explain what really happened. And the third parties, of course, are also on one side or the other. So, you know, this is life. Among people, but within ourselves it can be even worse, right? So that, you know, you have, when you decide you want to make a decision, you have the voice of your father and the voice of your mother, and then you have the voice of people you care about, and so on and so on, and they're all telling you something different, and the poor little self is like pulled this way and that by these giants. who are telling you this is the truth, this is the truth, do this, do this. After a while you think, well, what should I do? I don't know what to do. And this is so common, at least for a certain kind of person. Zen has this idea of the natural self, your natural self, you know. And this is a wonderful idea. Most people don't live in their natural self. Most people live in like an idealized self, right? Most people, I think, create an image of themselves that they want to live up to. You know, it could be, when I first started teaching in the English department at Rutgers, there was a very famous professor named Richard Poirier. He's deceased, so I can use his name. Richard Poirier was very, very famous, and he was widely admired by all the young graduate students, especially the males. He was kind of a super masculine guy. And young men in our graduate program would sign up to study with Poirier, and it was considered a real honor to be liked by Poirier. And Richard Poirier had this incredible New England accent. He was a Maine person. And so he didn't say modern, the word, he would say modern, the modern. So it would be modern literature. Modern literature. And I had no idea what he was talking about. Modern, the modern. And then I realized modern, oh, modern literature. So anyway, you'd hear these graduate students in the hall going, modern. You think, huh? Are you from, you know, Maine? No. But they were imitating Poirier. I remember for a long time the Dalai Lama used to wear glasses, of a certain kind of glasses. And I noticed one time Richard Gere had exactly the same kind of glasses on in an interview. So Richard Gere imitated the Dalai Lama's glasses. You know. Now, you know, we all have to have ego ideals, right? Ego ideals. But it's very important to not try to be our ego ideal, but to be our natural self. This is the most important thing. See, if you create an ego ideal, it can become tyrannical and oppressive. So it's very common for people to create an ego ideal. You know, so if you admire the Dalai Lama, you want to be like the Dalai Lama. If you want to be like the Dalai Lama, you should have glasses like the Dalai Lama's. And when things happen to us, we can say, well, what would the Dalai Lama do? What would the Dalai Lama do? And this is actually something that's very common, but it's not necessarily that healthy for us. See, what's really better is for us to have the natural life, you know, so that we're not necessarily trying to please the Dalai Lama. We're actually happy. See, I mean, this is fascinating to me how people can live a certain kind of life, and then they wake up one day and realize, I've been doing what I thought was the right thing to do, and yet I'm unhappy. How can this be? See, I'm doing the right thing, I'm doing what I think is the right thing, but I'm unhappy. How can this be? All my life I've been trying to be the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama is always laughing. Why am I not laughing? And this is like a great mystery, actually. It's like we think we should imitate the Dalai Lama, maybe, or could be anybody. You like Miles Davis. You know, I mean, this happens all the time. people, you might like Miles Davis's music, and then you decide you're going to be like Miles Davis, you know. And so you become very cool and reserved and so on and so on. Apparently Miles Davis was very cool and reserved. People who hung out with him all tried to read his behavior so that they wouldn't do anything that was uncool. I remember reading this jazz musician was coming out of a club, and Miles Davis was coming down the other direction with his entourage of admirers. And this jazz musician was really happy. He had just come out of a performance where he gave a good performance, and he was sort of walking along feeling really happy, and he saw Miles Davis and he said, "Hi, Miles, baby, what's happening?" And then he realized he'd made a terrible mistake, because nobody talked to Miles Davis like that, right? That wasn't cool. And he said, "When I realized what I'd done, I didn't even stop. I went around the block, and then walked around the block and caught up with them at another location, and I didn't say a word, right?" It was like he was cool, right? He was in the cool behavior mode. So he had been his natural self, and then he had gotten slapped down for it by Miles Davis, and he was supposed to be a Miles Davis clone. So you know, you could think that this is what Zen is about too, that Zen is about producing people who will be Joshu clones or Dalai Lama clones. And it's possible to make that mistake, but please don't think that's what we're doing here. You know, I have had two wonderful teachers, Genki Roshi and Webb. But I don't try to imitate either of them, and I don't ever allow myself to say, "Well, what would Genki do?" or "What would Webb do?" Because that's not a healthy mindset. I have to ask my true nature what to do. And it's really no help at all trying to decide what Webb would do or what Genki would do, because, you know, they're different people in a different situation. I have to act from my own situation, and that means I have to be true to my true nature. So as soon as we find ourselves, you know, it's hard to tell, you know, what our true nature is. It's hard to tell because, you know, often when we start practicing Zen, we're sort of embarrassed by ourselves, or we might even be like ashamed of ourselves. And so when we're practicing Zen, you know, there's an element of maybe shame or embarrassment or dissatisfaction with ourselves, and we're practicing to be better selves, right? And we're practicing more and more diligently, more and more wholeheartedly. What eventually happens, if everything works out all right, if you really practice wholeheartedly, is you realize that you're okay, you know. You actually love yourself, you know, just as you are. And that's really quite remarkable. It sounds trivial, right? And you might even think, how could I possibly love myself? You know, that's so impossible. I'm such a lazy bum, or I'm so stupid, or I'm so unsuccessful, or I'm so... But it's very, very important. You know, in Zen, we sit on the cushion, and we're in deep samadhi, and eventually we discover this incredibly powerful compassion in ourselves. And, you know, it's so powerful that we even feel compassion for ourselves. You know, it's easier sometimes to feel compassion for others than it is to feel compassion for ourselves. To just, you know, to just actually think, you know, you're doing a good job, you know. You know, say to yourself, you know, actually I'm doing a good job. You know, actually I'm okay. You know, it's like the bodhisattva of wisdom could just lean over and give you a big kiss right on your forehead, right? You could be sitting on the cushion thinking, I'm not answering my koan, my posture's not good, blah, 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 and then the bodhisattva of wisdom is going to lean over and give you a big kiss right on the forehead. say, oh, you're such a good girl, you're such a good boy, you know. That's really a wonderful moment, you know, and that's what Zen is all about, you know, really. The Dalai Lama, I mentioned this yesterday, but whenever he's interviewed, he often says, oh, I am just a simple monk. I am just a simple monk. And people think, oh, isn't he humble, right? And they think, but he's the Dalai Lama. But actually, if the Dalai Lama is telling the truth, he's being really honest. He doesn't have to pretend to be something special. He's just who he is, you know, a simple monk. And his simplicity is what really makes him so endearing to people. You know, so Zen is all about that simplicity. You know, there's always a doubleness or a split when we're not natural, right? So we have like a divided mind. And divided mind is, it takes a long time to create. When you're a little kid, your parents might say to you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you're thinking, I want to be a dinosaur, or I want to be, you know, I want to be a princess, or whatever. And your parents say, wouldn't you like to be an engineer? And you think, would that make you happy? Okay, yes, I want to be an engineer. Or yes, you know, now your parents love you. They would love it. I heard a mother on the radio talking about her kids, and she said, this woman was talking about her child and said, I hope he becomes a crusader for human rights, or an engineer, she said. So she was thinking, crusader for human rights would be good, but on the other hand, if he's an engineer, he'll always have a job, you know, he won't be worried about money, you know. So she loved her son and cared about him. So he's growing up, and somebody's going to say to him, what do you want to be? And he might say, either a crusader for human rights or an engineer. And then he looks and mom has a big smile. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But you know, he might be a crusader for human rights and one day say, I'm not happy, I wonder why. You know, I was reading this article that something like 65% of doctors wish they hadn't gone into medicine. And I just think that's incredible because, you know, doctors have a lot of prestige. They have good incomes. It seems they have great job security. People are always going to be sick, you know. So it seems like medicine is like the ideal profession, and yet 65% of doctors don't like being doctors. And I just think that's fascinating. You know, so it must be that a lot of those people who went into medicine were not being true to their true nature, you know. This doesn't mean we don't sometimes have to do things that aren't top of the priority listing, you know. Sometimes we have to do things that we don't necessarily, that aren't on the top of our list. But, you know, what can happen as you grow up is that if you're ashamed of yourself, which is quite common, or if you've been made to be afraid, you know, we can't quite say what we want, you know. If somebody says, what do you want to be? You don't say a rock musician, you know, you say an engineer. But this creates a kind of divided mind, you know, where we're not open and honest about ourselves. And we're always looking for the self we should be. Instead of, I think a healthier way of life is finding a way to be that we in which we can be wholehearted. It's very complicated, actually. You know, usually the mind is like a labyrinth. Should I do this or should I do that? You know, And we take this road and we regret not taking the other road, and then we take that road and we regret not taking that road, and so on. As you get older, you might actually, if you live a certain way, you might have more regrets rather than fewer regrets. I think that the good thing about Zen is that if you live a whole unified mind, with a unified mind, and you're true to your true nature, and if you live that way, I think you have a greater simplicity as you get older, greater simplicity. Yes, greater simplicity. That's worth a lot, in my opinion. In Zen practice is really about cultivating that simplicity, or getting in touch with that simplicity. So when we're in the moment, instead of saying what should the moment be, we are present with the moment as it is. See, that's very difficult sometimes for people, because we wish the moment would be different. One of the most elemental facts about many people is that they don't want to be here. Wherever they are, they don't want to be there. They want to be somewhere else. And this creates a divided mind. Zen is about learning how to be happy where you happen to be. My first teacher said, if Zen training makes it possible for you to be like a flower in a vase, and wherever you're placed, you're beautiful. It's like, you see these beautiful flower arrangements, Japanese flower arrangements. Wherever you're placed, you're beautiful. You can be put here, you can be put here by life, and wherever you are, you're going to be just the flower you are, and you're going to be beautiful. And often people have a great deal of fear about being who they are. But if you practice Zen, eventually, it's possible to be simple and to be fully present here, where you are. And Zen creates simplicity with a number of different strategies. One of them is koan training. And koan training is interesting because it works like this. Your small mind thinks it knows you, but it doesn't. Your small mind thinks it knows you, and it thinks it understands everything, but it doesn't. So if you ask the small mind, what do you want to be? The small mind says, I want to be a crusader for world peace or an engineer. See, and if you ask the small mind that question 100 times, you'll get the same answer. And you might think, oh, that person really knows what he wants. But if you work with a koan, see, koan is different because it goes to a deeper level of the mind. And the answer that comes out of you when you use a koan might be very different from what your small mind imagines. So there isn't necessarily a koan about what job you're going to pick. But if there were, your small mind might say, crusader for world peace or engineer. But your big mind might say, I want to paint, or I want to be a gardener, or I want to take up surfing, I want to be a surfer, or whatever. Maybe you want to, you say, after all, I do want to be a crusader for world peace. So looking in getting around the small mind is part of the function of a koan. So see, it's very difficult for us to be true and to be wholehearted. And so often in life, we're just giving the answers we think we should give. And the koan is getting us to do something very different. The koan is getting us to speak from a deeper part of ourselves. See, it's speaking from that deeper part of ourselves. It's like the unconscious is speaking. And the conscious is saying yes, but the unconscious is saying no. See? That's one way koans can help people to become simple. But there's another aspect of Zen simplicity, and that is this idea of just being fully present here and now. And so, you know, there's also this practice of shikantaza, of being in the moment, of just moment-by-moment awareness, which, by the way, is what this koan is all about, finally getting to the koan. A monk asked Joshu, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? See? And Joshu said, it's like throwing a ball into the rapids. A monk later asked Tosu, what's the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said, nen after nen without ceasing. Now, I've talked about this before, but the nen is a moment of consciousness, in it's a Japanese term. There are three parts of every moment. And if you watch the moment very, 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 very carefully, you'll notice that this is the case. The first part of the moment is pure awareness, without any interpretation. It's just, each moment is exactly the same in its structure. You have a moment of pure awareness, then you have a thought, that's the second nen. And then there's usually some kind of an emotional charge. So it's pure awareness, thought, and emotional charge. And what happens is the moment actually is very fresh and new as it arises. And then as thoughts begin to form, the moment becomes more rigid. And as you have emotion, it begins to decay, actually. This is a process that goes on and on. Every moment has this same structure. And so, basically, our lives are just a series of these waves, right? Rising out of emptiness and going back into emptiness. And they have this structure. So, the art of shikantaza is focusing on the front of the wave of the moment. So right now, you might have pain in your knees, you might hear the jet plane overhead, you might be swallowing, you know, whatever. And each of these is presenting itself to you, and if you're very distracted, it's all sort of a jumble, right? It's just a jumble. But if you're very focused, if you're watching the breath and your mind is very poised and one-pointed and balanced, you can begin to take on each of these moments one by one. You see that, you know, you're aware of this and then this and then this, and if your mind is even more acute, you can notice the coming and going of the sound or the coming and going of the sensation, only to be you know, you might feel that the sensation of pain in your knee is continuous, but it's not. There's a moment of pure experience, there's some kind of a recognition, there's some kind of an emotional reaction, ouch. And then you're back again to the next wave. Well, this is very healing. You know, staying with the moment and just practicing moment by moment awareness is tremendously healing, I actually think shikantaza is like the most healthy practice for the mind. You know, a koan training is also wonderful. But if you lose your mental balance, there's a couple things you can do. One is to go back to the breath, right? And actually, breath meditation is moment by moment awareness, right? So you just keep bringing your mind back to the breath, and you're staying right at the front, the first nen. Right at the front of the wave. And if you do this for a little while, you'll grow calm and your mind will be stable and you'll feel much better if you're agitated. And so breath perception itself is a kind of shikantaza, moment by moment awareness. But you can get fancier. You can be aware of your breath, but then you can also be aware of, it's not just breath, 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 it's breath, knee, breath, car, you know, knee, breath. So, you know, you don't have to verbalize, but noting the cricket, chirp, chirp, car, plane, chirp, knee, you know. You can be much better at this than I am right now if you're focusing your mind. And what you'll find when you do this is that you begin to feel very calm, very centered. You're where you should be, right? And actually, when you get off the cushion, you might actually be rather happy. Feel rather good, you know. So just being fully in the moment is very restorative. You know? These are different ways of, you know, as I say, we kind of create a sort of an artificial self based upon what others would like us to be. And we could actually spend many, many, many years trying to live out this artificial self and be the person others would like us to be. And indeed, if we're successful at it, it could be very gratifying in certain ways, you know, because everybody would be saying, oh, you're such a great doctor, right? But you might wake up one morning and suddenly realize, I'm very unhappy, even though I'm a great doctor. And if this happens to you, it's because you haven't been true to your true nature. And being unhappy is not the worst thing in the world, right? Because it's like a message from your deeper mind saying, please change your life. Okay, being unhappy means please change your life. And many people just shove that unhappiness back in the bag, but you don't have to do that. You could say, you know, something's making me unhappy. I need to investigate. And you can work on moment-by-moment awareness, or maybe you're working with a koan. But you suddenly might realize, I'm 50 years old, and I have been living the life my father wanted me to live, but it's not the life I want to live. Or, you could wake up one day and say, I'm a full professor, or I'm a vice president of personnel, and I'm drinking a lot. I wonder why that is. You know, it's not just stress. It's something about the way you're living. You know, you're not being true. Even if a person could try to be the Dalai Lama and one day wake up and say, I'm really depressed. I have the glasses. I have a robe. My head is shaved. I recite the sutras every day. Why am I down? You know. But maybe you're not really supposed to be like the Dalai Lama, you know? Every snowflake is a little different, yeah? That's really a wonderful thing. So that sounds trivial, right? But we think, oh, but he's the best snowflake, and every snowflake is best. See, I mean, people kill themselves, you know, because they think, they measure themselves against people who are totally unlike themselves and come from a very different context, you know. I was reading that Jonathan Franzen got, I think, the National Book Award. Or did he? I'm not sure. But his book has come out, his new book has come out, and the title escapes me, but apparently it's been selling like hotcakes. It was on the top of the New York Times bestseller list. And I thought to myself, oh, there's so many writers right now who are probably, if they're writers and they're writing what they really want to write, they probably don't care. But if they're writers who are a little bit neurotic, they might be just looking at Jonathan Franzen and crying inside, thinking, oh, I've worked so hard and he gets on the bestseller list. Why not me? See? And that's very human response, but it shows that somebody's not living a true life. You know, I think that's fair to say that if you're really doing what you want, that kind of ratification shouldn't be so important. Right? If it is that important, then maybe you're not being true to your true nature. Naturally, it's important to listen to what people say. I ask people for advice all the time. But I'm just saying that it's very important not to try to be perfect, you know, because everything is perfect. So trying to be perfect, it's very important to be what you are, and to trusting your true nature. You know, Zen is about learning how to trust. The small mind says, no. But the big mind says, yes. So somebody works on a koan for 5 days and comes in and says, yes. You know, the small mind's been saying, no, and the big mind says, yes. And why couldn't we have known that at the start? Because we didn't trust. Right? Didn't trust ourselves. And that's a source of so much of our unhappiness. So, anyway, this is day two. Everybody's doing a wonderful job. They're supposed to fix the alarm around 3. So, you know, basically we'll be sitting in here and they'll be fixing the alarm. It's actually a phone line that caused all this problem. So anyway, we're going to have a wonderful time if we're just true to ourselves, true to our true natures. And Zen is, I think, really wonderful once people loosen up and really can be natural. You know, just give up, be in the moment, let the koan do its work, and it could be really great. So let's just sit. We're here together. Beautiful day. Everything's pretty good, right? Most of our unhappiness we have created with our own minds, and we can liberate ourselves very easily if we do some more zazen. So let's do it.